Hi, I'm Robert Guignard, and this is Intentionally Overheard. Today I'm going to have a conversation with Quentin Skip Lockwood III. Skip has 25 years of experience successfully managing nonprofits and businesses. Currently, he is the owner and operator of QL3 Strategies, a consultancy providing nonprofits with the technical, ethical, strategic, and operational expertise necessary to fulfill their missions. Skip served as president and CEO of Zero, the End of Prostate Cancer, where he spearheaded multiple initiatives to create an award-winning, multi-million-dollar, best-in-class organization. He crafted an innovative male healthcare program, the Drive Against Prostate Cancer, providing more than 100,000 men with free prostate testing through a unique for-profit nonprofit partnership. Skip possesses an MA in American Government from the Johns Hopkins University and a BA in an interdisciplinary study of political science, economics, and ethics. We caught up to talk about the importance of work-life balance, weathering life storms that come our way, finding your support tribe to get you through the tough times, and dealing with being stuck on a place called Unemployment Island. And now my conversation with Skip Lockwood. Hey there, Skip. How are you? It's good to see you.
It's great seeing you, Robert. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
I'm just so glad we finally were able to catch up and have this conversation. I know we had a couple of false starts before, but I am so happy to be with you and hear about what's going on. So thank you so much for taking the time out. And Skip, as you know, I always begin these conversations with the question, how are you treating life and how's life treating you back, my friend?
It's not bad.
You still have this sunny disposition. You have been knocking it out of the park in terms of how you just continue to persist. And so tell me a little bit about that. What's this sunny disposition about, Skip?
Well, I mean, I think it's a number of things. On one hand, it's a little bit Dickensian, and it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. I have an amazing family. I get to spend a lot of quality and important time with them, especially in ways that my father was never able to do. Right now I function kind of as the central caregiver for the kids, central transportation mainly. You know, I interact with them and participate in their lives in a way that my dad was never able to participate in my life. And so that's on the good side. Also on the good side, I have a couple of very good clients that I very much enjoy working with because they are very diverse and interesting. I'm currently working, and I guess I get the add executive producer to my resume now because I'm working with a small public access channel, and we're trying to make them more relevant to their community. So I've spent the last few weeks developing a new television show for them that is very hyper focused on the small community that it serves and really pulling forth some important ideas there. Yeah. On the more difficult side, the challenging side of things, professionally, it's still very difficult to get new clients. And there's a number of reasons still really having to push hard to find, there are a lot of organizations that need help out there, but not all of them either recognize they need it or are ready to commit to what it takes to get that help. And so it's a constant, it's a constant hustle to get them to engage. And in many cases, they're slow, they're hesitant, they are concerned, and they're in many cases overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And that's what happens with a lot of nonprofits and a lot of organizations is that they keep trying to do it all by themselves up until the point where it's very difficult to provide them the help they need.
Skip, let me do this because I want to give our listeners a little background as to how you and I met. You were then CEO of Zero, the End of Prostate Cancer, and I am a prostate cancer survivor, and I found my way to the organization through a run walk series. Yep. I want to say that was back in 2013 or so. Yeah. And I was so impressed with the organization and still impressed with it. So that's how you and I met. I became a board member a couple of years later after being involved in the Run Walk series. And so that's how you and I met. And I'm happy to say that our friendship has extended well beyond your time at Zero and my time at Zero. So just again, I wanted to give our listeners a little background about Skip, and we have a little bit of history. And Skip, so that leads me to the conversations that we've had over the past couple of years. You know, here you were the CEO of this organization, and you left to go up to upstate New York to manage a business or CEO of a business. And so that worked for a while, and then there was some change that took place. And you found yourself having to make adjustments in life. I want to talk about that adjustment, because one of the remarkable things about that experience is you hit a rough patch, but then you were able to turn that thing around and work it to your advantage. And then you also, it allowed you to do more things with your family. And also, Skip, tell us briefly about that transition and then that rough patch and what got you through that.
Well, it's so first of all, I hate to tell you this, but it was, I think, 2011.
Okay. So you had to add an extra 2 years. So I guess that's the gray hair.
I know the first couple of years were a blur.
Okay.
The people that are important to your life, when you find them at the right time, it's the right time. Yeah. And I'm very fortunate. When I came up here, the intent was that I was going to assist in transitioning two family businesses that into their next phase, and whether that was going to be passed on, sold, liquidated, you know, the decision, you know, I was coming up here to get them ready for the next, you know, whatever was coming next. Unfortunately, when timing came for certain decisions to be made, the powers that be balked, as I like to say, chose option C, die at my desk, as the alternative for these for these organizations, which left me in a position of determining what do you want to do next? How are you going to, because this, there's nowhere else to go here, and so. I went back to my roots, which is nonprofit work, and the work that I have, you know, had an extraordinary broad array of experiences with. And I started up my consultancy again and you know, started marketing myself. I got quickly landed a good-sized client. And what was initially supposed to be a three-month gig turned into a 10-month gig because of COVID and shutting everything down. And throughout all that, you know, COVID really suddenly complicated everything, because as somebody who was not inherent to the Central New York nonprofit sector, I was an outsider. And even though I did an exceptional job for the client, you know, I hired them, I knew their first high performing development director, completed some capital projects for them that had been languishing, you know, provided them with a real streamlining and cleaning of their operational systems and redid all of their computer systems so that they could manage data and use it for fundraising and maximizing their mission. But at the end, you know, when that came to an end, there wasn't anything after that, because nobody else in town knew me, and all of the, ability to network, to get out and around, had all been closed off by COVID.
Yeah.
And so here I stood at the other end of this without any ability to really change it.
Skip, I want to interject for just a moment, just to also let the listeners know that you were coming from a place, and that place is Washington, D.C., the Virginia area, Maryland, Washington, and Virginia. And so there were resources, there were people, you had a network that you could turn to. So I guess it seems to me, without having that network, to be up in, you know, in Central New York, to not have to say, okay, well, you know, I'll make a call to all my resources that, you know, I have. I guess that had to be almost traumatic in a way too, in that you had no network there.
Yeah, it totally traumatic. And the worst part about it was, is that even the networking that I could do, and, you know, one benefit that I did have is my brother works up here and he is a housing specialist and he runs a nonprofit that does mixed income housing redevelopment. And so he has a lot of contacts up here, and he basically turned over his Rolodex to me and, you know, set up meetings for me. And I met with, you know, just about everybody that was available up here. The problem was, is there were no openings and there were no availabilities at the time. And with COVID, so many nonprofits were in financial extremis. The first people to go were the consultants. Right. Consultants are a lot like condos. They're the first down and the last up in value. And so, and that's one of the, and you know, that's one of the challenges. And, you know, it's hard to sell people on something that, you know, it's kind of like deciding, you know, when people go to a personal trainer, it's usually because they finally decided that they can't do it on their own.
Yeah.
They can't accomplish whatever fitness goal that they're searching for. They're no longer able to do it on their own. And so that's when they finally start going for somebody to provide guidance and support and help them move forward. And I think what happens with a lot of nonprofits, especially in times of economic distress, is they become hyper-conservative.
Yes.
Or the board becomes hyper-conservative because they're very concerned about the future. It's very uncomfortable not being able to, you know, for many nonprofits, they have a fairly stable base of income that they can count on from year to year. And when that gets called into question, everybody gets very, very nervous very quickly about what they want to do. And so instead of saying, you know what, we should get a personal trainer that could help us develop beyond where we are, they close up and they kind of get in a cocoon and try to wait out the disaster wait out the challenge and then come out of that, even though they've probably set themselves behind because they failed to act.
You know, see, what's interesting though, is when you bring up the point of knowing when you need help, you know, that personal trainer, I think resonates with a whole lot of people, but book after book, always, they always point out that the key to realizing true success is at some point you realize you can't do it by yourself. Oh, right. You have to humble yourself to say, I don't have all the answers. I want to take it to the next level. I need to reach out to someone to help me. And so you become, you know, you have to be vulnerable to say, I need help. I don't have all the answers. And so that personal trainer analogy you used was just, it hits home because most people think, I can do it on my own. All they're going to do is yell in my ear like, four more. Yeah. 10 more, you got this. And so, you know, but what's interesting about your story, Skip, is that, you know, that, and you've been quite public about it, but you mentioned how that isolation, that lack of a network really kind of played some games on the mind a little bit with you, in that you were isolated, and you wrote a wonderful article about Unemployment Island. So this was the point that you had started the consulting, and you know it didn't really take off at that point, but you were still looking for work. But you mentioned about Unemployment Island, and you likened it to Gilligan's Island. And you know, as I read through the article, and by the way, I'm a kid of the 60s. And so Gilligan's Island was my favorite show. And every week I was rooting for them to get off the island. And it got to a point where I'm like, you know what? I'll take the coconut mug. You know, just have fun on the island and, you know, just take it all in and come to the realization that's going to be your resting place. But your article touched on so much of what they went through on the island, and but you were also experiencing that in real life. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. It's I love the beach. I love the islands. Sailor, any scuba diver, anytime you can get me in the ocean, I'm a happy camper. Especially if it's warm. You know, one of the things that fascinated me is, I love Robinson Crusoe and, you know, all of the Swiss Family Robinson and, you know, Ernest Shackleton, all of these explorers who've done these, dealt with these incredible challenges and, you know, how they go about it. And so one of the things that struck me is that especially, you know, Unemployment Island is like being on an island, because when you're working, you have a group of people around you. You have a community around you. They may not be exceptionally close. It's not that you're friends with all of them, but you are constantly in interaction and you are constantly engaged with them in one form or another. And Unemployment Island is a lot like Gilligan's Island in the sense of all of a sudden you're isolated. You can't just reach out and grab people and get their attention and get them to listen to you. And there's also a loss of status. Yes. When you're on Unemployment Island, it doesn't matter if you were the CEO or the president or the chief accountant. You're not any of those things when you're on Unemployment Island. And so you lose some of that ability to, we'll call it impress people.
Yes.
That you know, when you're out, you know, it's one thing, you know, I can't tell you all the times it used to kind of make me a little always just slightly uncomfortable. And, you know, I would go somewhere for zero and then like, you know, might be a small gathering like this is the president and CEO of Zero, the end of prostate cancer. And they're doing all these wonderful things. And, you know, people are coming up to you after and say, oh, you're doing such wonderful work and you're great. And wow, what a good idea. And we're so excited to be a part of these things. And, you know, but when you take that away and you put the same, you know, if I went in front of the same people and you just said, and this is Skip Lockwood, let's, you know, he's going to talk to us about something. And even though they might find it interesting, it doesn't have the same gravitas. And so yes. when you're on Unemployment Island, you don't have that, you've lost that asset that allows you to go to other people and say, hey, you know, let's talk or let's engage, or they yeah. have a desire to engage with you as opposed to, well, you know, I talk a lot about the guest stars.
Yes, please dive into that. And,
you know, one of the things that's interesting about Gilligan's Island is like every week there's somebody who magically finds their way to the island. Most every week there's somebody magically finds their way to the island through one absurdity or another. And they meet with the castaways, and the castaways are like, hey, this is great, and da 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 da. And then there's usually a way off. My particular favorite, which is so absurd, was the one where the pro surfer rides the tsunami to the island. Then the professor figures out that the tsunami going back the other direction is going to take off in a day or two. And so, you know, the whole thing is everybody's all excited. Oh, man. And he's going to go back and tell us where we are and give us all this, you know, then they're going to send rescue and it's going to be awesome. And then, boom, the guy's gone and you never hear a thing. Nothing happens.
Oh, and, you know, excuse me for a second, Skip, because I'm over here cracking up because I remember those episodes like I just watched them yesterday.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And I remember the surfer. So I'm sorry.
No. Go, I mean, go ahead. You know, I love the professor because, I mean, this guy could make anything but an escape. And, you know, I still remember, and I talk about it in the story a little bit, is like I was, you know, so desperate to find some way off. I even did a radio. I paid for a few weeks of radio advertising on NPR in our area to try to engage us. And I got the same result as the time that they tried to light the fire so that the Russian cosmonauts could see it in space. Nothing. Nobody saw nothing. And very similar. But it's, and if you were not on an island, if you were on the mainland and there were other people around you and there were things happening and geographically, you would have a much better, you know, you could leave, you could go somewhere else, you could move around, you could do these changes. But on their island and on unemployment island, you're kind of trapped in a particular place. And so there was a lot, you know, that was very, very challenging. Not least of the which is the way most of us enter unemployment island is in a storm of some kind.
Yes.
We don't, most of us don't come to unemployment island and say, you know what, I would like to just step out of the workforce for a while. I mean, I guess it happens more often now, but certainly people of our age. Yeah. that was not really thought as optional.
Yeah.
And so you arrive there because of a storm of some kind. You know, the company you were working for collapses, they get new management, there's a purge, or, you know, there are a number of reasons that you end up there. And when you end up there, it's not a happy landing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of rending of cloth and weeping and gnashing of teeth and a great deal of anger. And it takes a while to get over that and to get to the point where you can say, all right, we've got to figure out how to get off of this island. Yeah. And then, so that's kind of, to me, is stage one, is settling yourself to the idea that we're going to figure out how we're getting off the island. The second part of that is then going about the daily business of trying to get off the island. And that, and in and of itself, is a tremendously difficult activity. I actually said it's probably better chances of putting a message in a bottle and throwing it in the ocean than it is to send resumes and cover letters through employment portals and want ads and things of that, because they both have the same response rate, and they're both, we'll call them, doing something to doing for the sake of doing something.
Doing something, and yes.
It, you know, I always laugh. If you've watched Dumb and Dumber, there's a point where the Jim Carrey's moronic character has been pursuing this woman who's married for this for the whole movie, and at the very end, he's finally with her alone, and he says, "What do you think the chances are that we could have ever gotten together?" And she's like, "One in a million, one in a million." And he goes, "So you're saying there's a chance?" And that's exactly how it goes. That's how it goes, like when you're tossing these resumes out into the. So you're saying there's a chance that somebody somewhere is going to find this and find you and provide some rescue. Yeah. And so that's kind of like stage two. And that's when you're still doing all the things you need to do, you know, posting on social media, sure, and making sure you're resume and your public profiles and stuff are up to date. But I think there comes a point where you have to kind of calm yourself and realize that this isn't going to your rescue, especially if it doesn't happen fast. You know, if you don't get lucky, that you just have to resign yourself to building a life that you can live with on the, you know, on your island. And I finally took some solace in the idea of, you know, Robinson Crusoe finally reaches a point after all of his first being angry and then setting up for survival where he decides that it's time to build a life.
Yes.
And so now, you know, he starts doing things like, let's catch some goats and make some, you know, and so we have goat meat, and I'm plant some food now, and yeah, then I'm going to find a better place to live. And so it takes him a while, but he gets around to it of, let's build a life. And so that's what he starts doing.
And Skip, you laid that out perfectly, because one of the things, and I always enjoy talking to you about this, one of the things that you got to that point and you just said, hey, look, you know what? I still need to live through this process. Again, maybe it was geographic because of where we're located. Maryland, D.C., Virginia's traffic. You're just in traffic, commuting times, all of this stuff. You're going. And for you to come to that point where you're like, you know what? I'm going to go out to the backyard. Mm-hmm. I've got the ducks out there. I've got the beauty of the land and everything out there. And And that's when I noticed it turned around for you in that you started embracing this other part, like, okay, you know what? I've done the work piece, but now I've got to get out and live. One of the things that Gilligan's Island, I admired about them is that they became a tribe because they knew they had to rely on one another. It wasn't like they were being rescued in the next 30 minutes or so in the episode, but they became a tribe. So talk a little bit about that point where you said, you know what? I'm going to go out and I'm going to have my coffee outside. I'm going to enjoy taking care of my boys. I'm going to be here for my wife. And it was just this point. And I remember seeing how that evolved. Mm-hmm. So talk about that decision to say, look, you know what? Let me embrace this other side. And then also about the importance of the tribe.
Mm-hmm. So it was a long and difficult transition. And as my therapist is fond of saying, I spent a lot of time fighting it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of time fighting it and a lot of energy fighting what was.
Yes.
And one of the things, you know, several of the mechanisms that became incredibly helpful for me is I read a lot of philosophy in college, and I went back to some of that and started looking at it. And especially I did a lot of Greek philosophy, and I got turned back on to the Stoics. And it was the Stoics, and kind of there's actually a very large movement now on Stoicism. And I'm not talking about big Stoicism, which is being, you know, stern, unmoving, unmovable, dour. I'm talking about little Stoicism in the sense of looking at life and realizing, as Marcus Aurelius said, you can die tomorrow. So what are you going to do with the time you have today?
Yeah.
And getting into a lot of the ideas of trying to be much more not living in the past, not over projecting into the future, but being available at the moment and deeply in the moment. And that coupled with meditation, which I have found to be, for me at least, an incredible game changer. My biggest problem with meditation is that as an overachiever, I'm constantly trying to overachieve on something you can't overachieve on. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you again, I was talking to my therapist the other day, he's been deeply supportive, and he's very much into Stoicism and meditation and Buddhism. And we've had some really wonderful talks. But the other day I was telling him how I was listening to one of the teachers, and he was going on about this, you know, he was talking about equanimity and, you know, being, you know, not letting yourself, you know, kind of like being like the tree. You stand tall, but you still wave with the wind. You still have flexibility to move with the wind. And I was just lamenting. I'm like, I've only been doing this for 2 years now, but lamenting that I wasn't at a place where I was, you know, I could, you know, just be totally calm with all the things that hit me on any given day or in any given week. And, you know, my therapist started laughing, and he goes, you realize this is a lifelong practice, right?
Right. That you're trying to compress in 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, the object is, and it's the same thing with Stoicism and the way that Stoics approach the world. It's a practice. We've learned all kinds of things. You know, we talked earlier about people of a certain age being on unemployment island was unacceptable. That's a learned habitual activity in our head, and unlearning that and undoing that in the same way that, you know, so many of us have what I refer to as the committee in our head that goes on and provides extraordinarily excellent critiques of us. Silencing that committee is an activity that you don't get up in the morning and saying, I'm not going to listen to all the chatter that runs around in the back of my head all day. You know, it's a learned activity to get to out, you know, to quiet the, you have to train your brain to no longer allow those guys, girls, whoever is in your head to chatter along, cause suffering for you.
You know, and- Skip, I'll add this as well, is that, and I want you to finish that point. You know, I find that I go through some of the same things in terms of meditation, in that, you know, when you're trying to quiet the mind and all of these things that go on, we also have to realize we're of a certain age where we've lived long enough. So therefore, there's more there in our minds. You know, it's not like we're 19.
Yeah,
you know. No. I'll proudly say that I'm 59. So I've got 59 years of stuff up here, in addition to the daily things that go on and dropping the kids off to school and all of this stuff. And so, like you, I'm like, I should be able to condense all of this and have my quiet time and not let the chatter enter my mind. But, you know, we also have to recognize that we've lived, our lifespan is a little longer. So we have so much stuff upstairs that can cloud us getting to that quiet point very quickly.
Oh, yeah. No, being older gives us, we have more joys. We have more sorrows. We have more disasters. We've had more wrecks. We've had more mistakes. We've had more triumphs. And all of those add up together or accumulate, and they affect how we approach, you know, how we approach life.
Yes.
And for me, being able to have a propensity to reevaluate things all the time. Man, if I'd only not done this, then we could have done, you know, X would have happened. Or if this had only been, yeah, maybe. But the reality is that's all fantasy. It's all, you know, it's all me looking for the all, you know, for an alternative ending to something that perhaps I didn't like, or looking for a better ending to something that I did like. And so getting that under control helps to move to the next phase of being on unemployment island, which is probably the beginning of the really healthy phase of the island, is saying, look, it's time to build a life, and it's time to build something that is valuable and that is useful and that is pleasing. Does that mean, and the other part of that is, does building a life mean that it's complete? No. Because would I love to have some more clients? Absolutely. I feel like I have a tremendous amount of experience and skill making nonprofits into high performers and to helping them really fulfill their mission. And I would love to share that with a lot more people, because I feel like there's a real need out there for that to be done and to help them really achieve things that they want to achieve. At the same time, there's also time for me to work on my creative writing, which is something that has always hung around in the back of my head, but I finally committed to and, you know, more regularly, you know, participate in and provide. It's making time for family and being actually there and not constantly distracted. You know, my phone addiction, which, you know, my addiction's a long addiction, starting with the BlackBerry that was handed to me. And I can't tell you the hours that have been spent constantly, you know, cruising through the emails. And now, you know, if you look at your phone, I finally got to the point where I deleted Facebook from my phone, and I deleted LinkedIn for a long period of time, and have really just tried to step away from that, even though I still find it very difficult to, given my, given my druthers and nothing else happening, I'm inclined to check out my phone and, you know, one, to see if anybody has answered my call for rescue.
Right.
It's like, well, and here's The Economist and what's going on in the Times and Huffington Post. And, you know, and then I'm there instead of like being there with my kids.
Yes.
And because, you know, that's interesting and stimulating. Whereas the third time jumping on the trampoline with them is making me tired and sore. And so...
Well, it sounds like, Skip, though, you know, and you talked about getting on that, what brings you to that unemployment island is a storm. Mm-hmm. But it sounds to me, Skip, that through this storm, you have found the answers to a lot of stuff. And you've been able to experience now being present and living in the now. So it seems to me that, you know, they always say, you know, after the storm, the sun will shine. And it seems like you've been able to find a way to capture that sun and enjoy it now, even before, you know, maybe when prior to the storm, you knew the sun was there. You enjoyed it. Yeah, you like being at the beach. But now it seems to me that the sun has a different meaning and more encompassing. And I always tell my daughters that I'm like, the sun is always shining. Mm-hmm. However, there's cloud cover
right. That
obstructs the view sometimes, but you just kind of have to wait for the clouds to move by and you see the sun is still there. And so it seems to me that you've been able to really appreciate the sun now, even if it's behind the clouds.
Yes, but the only caveat I'll add to that is I still have to, and this goes back to the idea of practice, I still have to at times control or address, is probably a better term, the challenges that I get of feeling that I haven't done enough. Or I'm not doing enough, or that I need to accomplish something more, or that, case in point, man, do I need to, you know, now that COVID's largely slowed down, or at least a lot of people are now ignoring it, you know, should I be doing some more traditional marketing for my, you know, for the consultancy now? But then I also think, you know, how's that going to impact the writing and the kid time? And I'll back that, you know, you made a great reference to like living in DC, Maryland, and Virginia, in the sense of, I was talking to my brother when I was driving the other day, and I was just lamenting after my trip back from Baltimore, you know, how much the city was so great, and to have the energy and the vibrancy and the people and the interesting stuff and the great food. And he was like, yeah, but even if you could move back tomorrow to, you know, to that area, he's like, first of all, in order to get a job that pays enough in order for you to live the life that you need to live in that area, you know, you're back to a job that's going to be 70 hours a week,
yeah,
and 30,000 miles a year of flying. And you're back at a job that you're back at a place where you're planning, you know, we're going to the grocery store. Well, you know, it's going to take you 45 minutes to drive to the grocery store. Then there's the grocery store. And then there's all the people in the grocery store. And then by the time you get out of the grocery store, it's another 45 minutes home. And then there's getting all the stuff from the grocery store in and put away. And now that was 3 hours for the grocery store. Whereas now, you know, right now I can be in the grocery store and out of the grocery store in 20 minutes and back in the house. And you know, it's no big deal. And
yeah. A
lot of things that around here are in many ways, as much as I would love to have more engagement, at the same time, life's a lot easier in a lot of ways.
Are you living your life on purpose now? Has the storm uncovered or made you look inside and say, hey, look, this is who I am? You mentioned the creative writing and, mm-hmm. and I've, you know, you and I've talked about how important that is to you. Have you found that through this storm, you've kind of gotten your life on purpose and focused now?
I don't know. I still have a hard time answering that question about the purpose. And part of that's because when I worked at Xero, every day it was extremely clear what I was out to do.
Ah.
There was never a question at Xero of what needed to happen. We needed to find a cure for prostate cancer.
Yeah.
And every day was about a problem solving. How do we get to that end goal? And, you know, we were constantly looking about how we fit into what I call the prostate cancer ecosystem, which are, you know, the research, the advocacy, the survivorship, all of those things. It's constantly, you're constantly problem solving to see how you can push forward a little more to get to your end goal of a world without prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. That becomes much more difficult out now, kind of on my own.
Yeah.
So for one thing, so, you know, my tag phrase on my consultancy is helping those that do good do better. And that's great. And I love doing it. And, you know, the clients that I have right now, I've been extremely fortunate recently to have clients that are people I really respect and I like.
Yeah.
And so I'm able to engage with them and able to help push them forward on things and can build for me some of that personal satisfaction and professional satisfaction that I get from helping people do better. Do I have a sense now? It's harder to have that sense a little bit now with, is my purpose helping with the kids important? Vitally.
Yes.
Feel that way. Not like it used to, but it is important and it is valuable. And it's going to be really valuable. It's especially valuable to the three boys, but it's a lot harder to feel like I have that same tunnel vision or laser focus on a goal. And I think that's been one of the things I've struggled with is not realizing the purpose, but acknowledging the purpose.
Sometimes I think it's easier to work for someone else than to work on ourselves. So you mentioned how you were so laser focused when you were at zero. But you know, Skip, I think what happens is when we need to be laser focused on ourselves, that's where we fall short.
Well, and then, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier. It's a lot like, you know, we talked about tribe.
Yes.
And one thing that's important is like, I have two tribes in my life. There was the tribe of people that was from college. And then there was the tribe of people like when I lived in DC and in the DC area. And those people, that group of the DC, Maryland, Virginia group of about 20 people is extremely tight. And the thing about them is that I know I never have to question my value with them. I never have to question that, even if, you know, they're in some ways they're kind of like grandparents. Everything short of murder, they're still going to love you.
Yeah.
while everybody else is annoyed with you or disgusted by you or whatever, your grandparents are still going to love you. And in many ways, your tribe's the same way.
Yeah.
They're willing to help you. They're willing to be there for you. They're part of you. And that tribe, I think, helps push you forward a good bit. When we get outside of that and when we're at work, I think work, our professional life sometimes becomes a crutch for us for not having the tribe, or when we're not with the tribe or engaged with the tribe. I mean, we're dealing with people, they're friends or friendly, but you know, a lot of the people you work with professionally are not the people that are going to stand beside you come hell or high water.
Yeah,
So, but what that does is we focus on the professional. It's easy. Mm-hmm. It's in there. If you feel like you're doing a good job, it's comfortable. And, you know, you've got purpose, even if, you know, you're giving it to somebody else. When you're out on your own, you have to determine your purpose and it's not external to you. And your tribe becomes much more relevant. And so if you're not engaging with your tribe, the sense of isolation is enormous. And the only thing that's very frustrating is being with those people is a lot like sleep, in the sense of when you can't store sleep. So when you have a great night's sleep, it may help you for a day or so, or, you know, you'll feel great. But when it comes down to it, once you get back into the day to day in, you know, you start getting tired again and you don't have that, and you can't replicate it. So you either have to figure out how to have another good night's sleep, or you have to, you know, you've got to make other adjustments. Sure. For me, being like with my tribe this last weekend for the first time in a long time, it was an awesome high. It was the best 18 hours. But I also know that when we're done with that, you know, in the next 48, I need to start making some changes to keep engaged with those people so that I can use that to my, you know, for my own well-being. And that helps me to determine my, you know, that clarifies my purpose a little bit.
They become your energy source, that tribe. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
And well, you know, you have the confidence and you have the support behind you to move forward. They're the ones who are going to say, hey, that sounds kind of cool. Even though, you know, your new Jello wrestling, you know, your intent to enter into the WWE of Jello wrestling, just, you know, they're still going to stand. They may make fun of you about it, but they'll be behind you for it. Right.
Well, Skip, a question for you is, given all that you've experienced, if you had to go back and whisper in the ear of the 24-year-old Skip Lockwood, what advice would you give him?
That's a very good question. I think the biggest advice is don't take it all so seriously. Mm. And also trust yourself. I think for too often we embed our self-worth, our value, our performance in the assessment of other people. And so too often, you know, we, in order to feel fulfilled, we need the, whether it's our parents, whether it's our, you know, our peer, our colleagues, our peers, we place an inordinate amount of value on their perception, their opinion, their assessment of who we are and what we do and how we do it. Yeah. And that drives us, I think, to often do things that are not necessarily in our best interest, and certainly makes us beholden to others, because the other side of that is when that's withdrawn.
Yes.
For some reason or the other, it's devastating as opposed to just being annoying.
Yeah.
Because now you feel like, well, if they've withdrawn their assessment of me, their value of me, then that must mean something.
Something. Yes. Yes.
And it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, Skip, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And, you know, how can our listeners contact you, Skip? I know you have a LinkedIn profile and you reach out, and I find you very responsive on LinkedIn to folks. But how can folks reach out to you to talk with you further and possibly engage in your consulting services?
I have a great website, ql3strategies.com, where you can see the kinds of skills and performance enhancement activities that I do for nonprofits. As you said, LinkedIn profile, always glad to chat with people and make new friends there. And even just if you do a Google search, right after Skip Lockwood, the baseball player, will be Skip Lockwood, the consultant nonprofit.
And here, Skip Lockwood, right after the baseball player, you'll find him to be one heck of a person, very down to earth. And Skip, you always offer good advice, and I appreciate you being a part of my life for the many years that we've known each other, and I look forward to many more years in the future. So love you, my friend, and we will be in contact soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Robert. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Intentionally Overheard. If you like the show, please be sure to subscribe, leave a comment, and share this podcast with a friend. Until we meet again, your mind, heart, soul, and your best foot forward and dream it, believe it, do it, be it. Dibby dibby. Be sure to visit www.dreamitbelieveitdoitbeit.com. That's www.dreamitbelieveitdoitbeit.com.